And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host for today's program, and Jeff Brown is producing the show. Following National Native News, we're going to find out about this weekend's presentation of Nellie Cashman, A Northern Light, with guests Mark Whitman and Eve Dillingham. George Brown and Chris Nimi will be here to highlight events sponsored by the League of Women Voters. We're going to talk to John Hudson about his Wildlife Wednesday presentation on dragonflies of Alaska. And we're going to learn about the air quality monitoring program that's getting underway this season here in the capital city area, and an update on the annual Zippity-Doo-Dah concert coming up this weekend. All of that coming up next on A Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new report in British Columbia, Canada, shows that Native girls in the care of the provincial government are victims of sexual violence more than twice as often as non-Native girls. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the study comes from the province's representative of children and youth, who says it's time to address the problem.
The report suggests that at least 120 young people in care were victims of sexual offenses between 2011 and 2014. Of that number, 109 were girls, and of those, 74 were Indigenous. And Aboriginal girls represented 25% of the total children in care between those same years, but made up more than 60% of sexual violence victims.
Doesn't surprise me at all. I was victimized as a young child in the foster care system.
One woman still coping with the trauma decades after being abused by her foster father is C.J. Julian.
Really affected me to the point where I didn't have a voice, I didn't care about myself as a woman, I didn't value myself, I didn't understand.
Mary Ellen Turpel-Lafond is the representative of the children and youth in British Columbia. She calls the findings in her report troubling.
So we are dealing with an area, sexualized violence, that is tolerated to too high of a degree. We're not seeing leaders in our public justice systems talking about sexualized violence. We're seeing survivors talking about it to make it safer.
The actual number of victims is likely to be much higher because these kinds of incidents are usually underreported. And another troubling aspect is that nearly one in five youth harmed themselves or attempted suicide, often within a year of disclosing what happened to them. Turpel-Lafond says the only way there will be changes is if people become more aware of the problem and address it. She wants more child and youth advocacy centers, and that frontline workers have adequate policy standards and training with a focus on Aboriginal girls. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
K through 12 students on the Navajo Nation miss an average of a dozen days of school a year because of muddy, impassable roads. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports some members of Congress are trying to force the federal government to fully fund road maintenance on tribal lands.
There are more than 4,000 miles of dirt school bus routes on the Navajo Nation. They often wash out after storms, preventing many of the tribe's 85,000 students from getting to school. The federal government currently pays for about 20% of tribal road repair costs, with counties picking up the rest. Navajo Department of Transportation officials say maintenance is drastically underfunded. They back an amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill requiring the federal government fully fund the program. Democratic Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick co-sponsored the amendment.
I believe it is a civil rights issue. Many of these children spend hours a day on the bus each way because of the poor road conditions. These Navajo children have the right to equal access to education, and I stand together with the Navajo people to insist that this problem is fixed.
Navajo officials say poor road conditions also hinder emergency response and increase the number of vehicle crashes. According to Kirkpatrick, her plan would add $1.5 million to the Bureau of Indian Affairs Road Maintenance Fund. It would be offset by making cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency's budget. The House has approved the bill, and it's currently under consideration by the Senate. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The city of Lawrence, Kansas, has proclaimed the first week in October as Haskell Indian Nations University Week. Steve Prue is administrative assistant to Haskell's president.
It speaks to the city's support for our institution and for the education of Native people as they come to Lawrence and experience that.
The tribal college represents more than 130 Native nations. Haskell is hosting an event Sunday in recognition of its contributions and connection to the city. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And our first topic today on a Juneau afternoon is the title of this presentation is Nellie Cashman, A Northern Light. And this is a historical interview with Miss Ellen Cashman. It's going to be performed by Eve Dillingham and Mark Whitman, October 7th and October 8th at the Alaska State Museum. So in the studio, Mark and Eve are here, along with Jackie Manning, curator of the exhibits over at the State Museum. So welcome to all of you. Oh, got to get those mics on, Jeff. So let's do that again. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Very good. There you are. So, boy, tell me about Nellie Cashman.
Nellie Cashman, well, she is the hidden treasure of Alaska. When we say Northern Light, we don't mean the church. We mean a star on the flag of Alaska. If there was ever an individual who showed what resourcefulness and giving and generosity can be, it's Nellie Cashman. And she belongs to us, Alaska, not Arizona, not California, not Canada. She's ours.
So, real quickly, who is she? How is it that she became a topic, a subject matter for you guys to write this whole interview and put this presentation on for the public?
Go and let Nellie speak for herself.
Well, I attribute it to Mark, actually. Mark has had some interest in some individuals in Alaska, particularly in Juneau. China Joe is the first one that comes to mind. And through that research, I think he has stumbled upon some pretty interesting characters. And one of them, of course, was Nellie Cashman. She was a miner in Alaska. But at the time that I think that she would have been involved with China Joe, they would have been in British Columbia. And China Joe, of course, was a baker here in Juneau. Is that right, Mark?
Yeah.
Baker, and Nellie was a, she sort of started out boarding house operations and then moved into mining. So anyway, I attribute a lot of this interest in Nellie Cashman blooming through Mark's kind of rabbit-holing discovery of research on individuals in the territory.
Yeah. Nellie is... You know, I think I found every character I could find, and then she jumps out of the woodwork of history. You go down to Arizona, and she's friends with Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and all the others, but she spent over 30 years of our life. She's an entrepreneur. She's a restaurant owner. She studied nursing. She did mining. And she's known as the miner's angel here in Alaska, and there's a real reason for that. And she took the fortune that she made, and she used it to help our state again and again and again.
So known as the miner's angel, why? Without giving too much away from your, you know, for people who are going to come and learn all about her, but just a few more of these nuggets about, no pun intended there with the nuggets, but about her, because it's a fascinating story.
Because when no one else, when no man in Victoria would venture out against the elements and would try and save men who were dying of scurvy, she found a way. She found a way through her own grit and determination to save the lives of many, many men. And that's what we'll be talking about on both Friday and Saturday. We will conjure her forth that she may be here now with you.
That's what you think.
So, Mark, you're the interviewer.
I am Dr. Hugh McCormick.
Okay.
Historical conjurer.
And Eve, you're Nellie.
I'm Nellie. Yes, I am.
So for people who are going to show up or people who are thinking about showing up, is this a two-part like play or how? Just what are they going to see? A little bit about what they're going to see, the space they're going to be in, and how it's structured.
We're going to be holding it in the Science on a Sphere room, which is a circular, small room. We love this space. We love this time of year. It's when we get our city back. And we as a community can sit down in an intimate circle and share our treasure, which is local history. And this is an absolute diamond. I mean, I have probably spent about a good 3 years researching. We've taken her words from her interviews and her writings and newspaper stories and used that as the text for her. She's coming through in her own voice. And I have to say, Eve is solid gold, isn't it, Cashman? Bring your Irish.
So, Eve, when you started to get involved with this project, I mean, what jumped out to you in terms of this story that you were going to get to kind of inhabit this character and this person? I mean,
Just to step back a little bit, I attended Mark's performance of his research done on the Birch Brothers, which was the last production done in the old Alaska State Museum before it was raised and the new one was built. So he did the last performance in the old one. He's doing the first one, I believe, in the new museum. So kind of a christening here. You don't want to miss Mark Whitman's productions, in my view. And, of course, I went, and it was wonderful. And I went up to tell Mark so, because, you know, I just have to say what I feel. And that week, Mark contacted me and said, you know, would you be interested in taking a look at this this person that I've encountered and considering her for doing a project in the future? And, of course, Mark just asked me to do this. Of course I'm going to look at it, you know. And he dropped by a vanilla folder filled with, you know, copies, Xerox copies of research that he'd done, little snippets here and there on this woman. And I began to read these fascinating bits about her and thought, oh, my gosh, I'm all worked. Sign me up. Where do I sign?
Yeah. This is a world premiere, correct?
This is a world premiere. And here's the point. Nellie Cashman is someone who people know about in history. But most Alaskans, you mention her name and they go, who's Nellie Cashman?
Yeah, right.
This woman should be on the flag. I mean, for the time that we're going through, she had the answer to building hospitals, using all the money she made from gold to help the poor. And she did everything from being a mother confessor to an embalmer, you name it. And Eve has been so determined. She has gone to her gravesite. She has gone to her archives in Victoria. She's gone to Dease Lake, where she had a boarding house way up the Sakine River. And she's been down in Arizona where she lives. She inhabits Nellie.
Are you living and dreaming Nellie these days? Or not quite? Or
well, I'm certainly trying to learn her by heart before I get on stage.
Jackie, just I'm curious, this space, is this the first time you're going to be having a performance in this space? The museum's open, so there's a lot of new opportunities happening.
This is the first time we're having an event in that space, and you know, it is, like Mark said, it's a more intimate space, and we set up the stage the other day, did some lighting for it, and I think it's going to be a fabulous spot for this production.
Yeah.
So we're really looking forward to it. They did a run through the other day, and I kind of eavesdropped, and it was wonderful. There's music, is that correct?
Yep.
And the costumes look fabulous. So I'm just as excited as I think everybody else to see this new production. And Mark's previous ones were that I've seen on China Joe, Mark Willoughby, all of that was fabulous. But we do have tickets available at the front desk at the museum, and it is a free event, but it does have limited seating. Mm-hmm. So we do recommend that you come ahead of time, pick up a ticket. We have a limit of two per person, and please come get a ticket so you are guaranteed a seat. And it will start at, we have two different shows, one on Friday night at 7 and the other event is on Saturday at 2 o'clock at the museum. The New State Museum.
It's pretty exciting. World premieres are always a good thing. Alaskan history, especially at the museum, with you people in particular producing this for the community.
Beyond anything, our desire is to share Nellie's story, because for the time that Alaska is facing right now, this is the kind of Alaskan we need, who their whole life said, hey, what can I do for this place? Not just what can I take, what can I give back? How can I make community? And Nellie was a Northern Light.
Well, it's tempting just to talk to you for another 15, 20 minutes about this, and then we'd probably get into lines from the performance itself. But we're going to have to wrap this up. So was there anything else, either one of you, Eve or Mark, that you really wanted to mention here before we kind of wrap this up?
Well, I just wanted to say that Nellie questions if I have the ability to truly call her forth for this history.
I've asked for your bona fides, Dr. McCormick.
And you're making my Irish Celtic knot rise in anger.
And you better use that Celtic knot to try and conjure me then.
Well, the two of us will be there.
It's a remarkable community, the artistic community here in Juneau, Alaska. And this weekend, Friday and Saturday night at the Alaska State Museum, Mark Whitman and Eve Dillingham will be putting on a world premiere of Nellie Cashman, A Northern Light, a historical interview with Miss Ellen Cashman. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 5th of October, 2016. It's the birthday of the philosopher of the French Enlightenment, Denis Diderot, born in Langres, France, in 1713. A good friend of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, they met regularly at cafes in Paris to talk about music and philosophy and their troubles with women. Diderot was the chief editor of Encyclopedia, the first book of its kind, reference book, to subject all of the entries to rational analysis. For example, the entry on Noah's Ark tried to estimate how many man-hours Noah and his sons must have spent shoveling manure off the boat. He wrote about coal mines and fleas, about duels, bladder surgeries, stockings, metaphysics, and how to make soup. It was Denis Diderot who said, "Man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest." It's the birthday of Helen Churchill Candie, born in New York City, 1858, who wrote a how-to guide in 1900 entitled How Women May Earn a Living. She had to do that after her husband became so abusive that she had to leave him with her two children. She wrote books about the decorative arts, a novel, moved to Washington, and became an interior decorator. She was in Europe early in 1912 and sailed back home on the Titanic on its maiden voyage, was rescued aboard lifeboat number 6, and wrote all about it for Collier's Weekly magazine. And it's the birthday of the rocket scientist Robert Goddard, born in Worcester, Massachusetts, 1882. He was inspired by H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds to try firing rockets. Made a liquid-fueled rocket in 1914, and then one that ran on solid fuel. On this date in 1926, he completed his first successful launch. The New York Times made fun of him back in 1926, and in 1969, after Apollo 11 left for the moon, the Times printed an apology, but Goddard had been dead for 24 years. And it was on this date, 1877, Chief Joseph surrendered to the United States Cavalry. He and his band of Nez Perce Indians had been fleeing through Oregon, Washington, Idaho, into Montana, where they were finally trapped only 40 miles from the Canadian border. And Chief Joseph made his famous surrender address, in which he said, "Hear me, my chiefs, I am tired, my heart is sick and sad. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." Here's a poem for today by Daniel Mark Epstein, Autumn Song. Little flower, you live in constant danger, likely to be crushed underfoot or torn by wind, sun-scorched, or gobbled by a goat. These October days, streaked with regrets and tears, are, like you, brindled flower, as they bloom and fade, harried by heat as much as by the cold. Our ship sets out to sea, not with ivory or gold in the hold, but with fragrant apples for cargo. Just so my days are not heavy, but delicate, fleeting, and vain, leaving behind the sweet, faint scent of renown that quickly will vanish like the taste of fruit passing from the tongues and hearts of everyone. Autumn Song by Daniel Mark Epstein, from his book Dawn to Twilight, published by Louisiana State University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, featuring the new flagship cafe and bakery located at 130 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at heritagecoffee.com.
And a big welcome to two of the board members of the League of Women Voters here in the capital city, the Juneau chapter. Is it called the chapter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So welcome to George Brown and Chris Neamey. Thanks for coming in. Busy time of year, I assume, for the league. And in addition to all of your activities that, you know, are going along with elections and campaign season and what have you, you have two events coming up, and I'm going to mention them real quickly here. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and also Monday evening, correct?
Right.
Yeah. You have a movie. It's a documentary. It's the title is Selma, The Bridge to the Ballot, and it's going to be at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. And you folks also have a wine tasting and silent auction fundraiser coming up, so I want to talk, just mention that at the top of the interview here. But first, League of Women Voters, for people who maybe are not familiar with what you do year-round or seasonally or what have you, just a brief overview of the league.
Well, we like to promote civic people, you know, to be involved in their government. And so we do registrations for voters. We have in the past hosted eighth graders and high schoolers that are local to visit their government to find out more about how government operates, and so we've participated in that. There are other activities that we do too, George.
Yeah, we have workshops on how to run for office,
Yes. And
we get quite involved with a number of legislative things, particularly up at our assembly level and also at the state level. So what we want is for people to be nonpartisan, to think about what the issues are, to listen to each other, and to be active citizens. And we particularly want people not only to register to vote, to get out and vote, and to be informed when they walk in the voting booth.
Yeah, civic engagement as a not only a right, but a responsibility in promoting that year-round. So, well, thank you for doing that. And before the microphones came on, we were talking about how long the League of Women Voters has been around a long time, correct?
It was formed right after women got the right to vote in 1920, so we're going to soon be 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And when that finished, the same leaders who brought that about, and that was a 70-year campaign, decided we want to stay involved, and they wanted women to do exactly what we talked about, to have people be responsible citizens.
Yeah, very good. So you have a couple of events coming up. So first, let's talk about the movie, Selma, The Bridge to the Ballot, at the Goldtown Nickelodeon this Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. and this coming Monday at 7 p.m. Tell us about the movie.
Well, first of all, I want to stress that with each showing, and the movie is 47 minutes long, it's a documentary that's made by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And after the movie, we will have some people to moderate discussion, because we really want people to get involved with what this is about. And so on Saturday and on Monday, Willie Anderson will be the moderator. On Sunday, Patricia Hall will be the moderator. We will also have people there to be able to register to vote, although we know the deadline for the November election is midnight, October the 9th. But we're always trying to get people to be registered, and we have some information about that. The movie, a good way to think about this, it was exactly 100 years from the end of the Civil War before our federal government first passed the Voting Rights Act. The history of who could vote in this country is nothing like it is now. The first people that voted were white males who owned property, and they were slaves. Think about all that. Well, when the Civil Rights Movement, and that was passed in 1963, when it got really going, young people in the South, black young people in the South, said, why don't our parents vote? And in Selma, Alabama, they realized they needed to make sure that this happened, and that's what this movie is all about. And when finally the march occurred, two years after they began their campaign, they marched from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery. 25,000 people, they drew supporters from all over the country. President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, and that was a huge change for the history of voting. And of course, today we're dealing with racism, all kinds of issues that tend to divide us. And this movie makes it so clear that those black young people who were in black high schools stimulated their teachers to go out and start trying to register to vote, and that changed so many things.
Is this something that you already had on the calendar many months ago, or is this something that as the election season has progressed, this movie, this kind of a documentary, you thought this would be a timely,
My wife, Dr. Carolyn Brown, gets a lot of information from the Southern Poverty Law Center. She learned about this. In fact, we showed it last April at our Alaska State League convention in Anchorage, and we're trying to get other leagues, there are four leagues in Alaska, to do the same sort of thing here. But the time and the conditions we're dealing with right now are so apropos to what happened then that we want people to learn and grow from that experience.
Chris, anything to add about the movie, or do you want to switch over and talk about the wine event? Okay, let's talk about so the Selma, the Bridge to the Ballot at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Saturday and Sunday at 4:00, Monday at 7 p.m. It's free, but you also have a moderated discussion following each of the presentations.
And on Sunday night, when we finish the afternoon matinee, it's around 5:30 or so, Colette Costa is going to telecast the second presidential debate at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, so they can stay for that.
Good for Colette. Okay, so tell her we're going to switch gears here and talk about the Wine Tasting and Silent Auction fundraiser.
Right. Okay, so it will be held on Friday, October 14th from 5 o'clock till 7:30 p.m., and that's going to be at the Rockwell Gallery. Tickets cost $30 for an individual ticket or $50 for two. You can buy them by PayPal online at juneaulwv.org. That's Juno League of Women Voters.org. Or you can email lwvjuno at yahoo.com for tickets. We will have some available at the door, but we encourage people to buy them in advance so that hopefully you won't run out of a ticket and so you'll be able to attend. It looks like it's going to be another good evening. We had our first event last year. There is plenty of good wine, good food. This year, because of the theme, we are going to have a women's suffrage photo booth, which will be kind of fun. And then we have the smooth musical stylings of Rob Cohen. So there will be a lot of good conversation, interesting people to talk to, and a silent auction. We had some really good gifts last year, and it'll be a fun evening, I think, for all, and it'll provide a way to help the League of Women Voters with its activities, because we are all volunteers, and it does cost money for some of our activities.
Is this a major fundraiser for you, or do you do several of them over the course of the year to make sure you've got cash to work with?
That's one of the major ones.
Yeah.
The dues is the main way.
Yeah.
This is really the only outside one to do. One thing I want to add, it's really important for people to understand when I said you have to be registered by midnight October the 9th.
Yeah.
But every 4 years, and this was added to the Voting Rights Act sometime after it was passed, anybody who is an eligible voter in the United States can register and vote on the day of the presidential election without having registered before. And I've learned this particularly when we register at UAS. There's students that have forgotten to do something back in their home states, and we tell them, just go in, and it'll be a question ballot. But if they are a valid citizen to vote, they can vote for those two people. Every 4 years they can do that.
For president and vice president.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
If we have students from out of state that would like to vote for their senators, they would need to have a ballot in advance to be able to do that.
Right, very good. Well, we've already run out of time, so thank you very much for both of you for coming in. But for a website for people to learn more about the league and about these events, is there an easy website access?
www.junolleaguewomenvoters.
Very good.
And all this information is on there. Thank you, Jamie.
And we're on Facebook, too.
So, George Brown and Chris Neamey, both of you, thank you for your volunteer service with the league and probably in a lot of other organizations all over town. So thanks for coming in and telling us about these two events coming up and about the league.
Thank you.
Lilacs
hearing just a little bit of music from Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair, live in concert this evening at the Gold Town Theater, 7 o'clock. This is one of those wonderful KRNN productions. I have no idea if it's sold out already or not, but over the course of the past week, I keep hearing bits and pieces of Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair, and it has always sounded great. So chance to come out and see some outstanding local musicians here in the capital city. That's this evening at the Gold Town Theater, 7 o'clock. Dragonflies of Alaska, that's the next topic on a Juno afternoon. We have John Hudson here, who is an Alaskan, I hope I get this right, odontologist?
Pretty close.
Pretty close.
It's probably better than I could do, well, actually.
So tell me, how do you pronounce it?
Odontologist is what I say, but I find that I pronounce a lot of scientific things incorrectly, but it works for me.
Well, there you go. And also Patricia Wary is here with the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, the Southeast chapter, is that correct?
Yes.
And you folks put this series on, I forget, is it mostly fall through the winter?
It's through the winter, so this is the first one.
All right.
And there will be about six, it'll go through April or May.
Yeah. And is it every week?
No, it's once a month. So
once
we
a month,
do
right.
the first Wednesday
first
of
Wednesday.
Every month. And then people can go hunting if they don't know what we're doing. That's the time. And the place is always constant. The Valley Library is what we're using now, the public library.
Yeah. So
our location and our time are constant.
Tonight at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay. Valley Library in the large meeting room. And the topic is Dragonflies of Alaska. And so, John Hudson, welcome to the studio. And I already said this to you before the microphones were even turned on, that I thought, you know, you think of Alaskan wildlife, and I don't think very many people have dragonflies pop up on their list of Alaskan wildlife. So tell us about dragonflies in Alaska.
Sure, yeah. Alaska's usually about, people talk about our charismatic megafauna, whether it's a whale or a bear or a wolf, but we have a lot of dragonflies in this state, probably more individual dragonflies than any other state or all of them combined, because we have so many wetlands and it's such a large state. Mm. But we have 32 species that breed here, and everything from the mosaic darners to the little sedge sprite, which is less than 3/4 of an inch long. And some of the darners can achieve 5 inches in
less
size.
Than 3/4 of an inch long.
Yeah, it's a cute little diminutive, brilliant green dragonfly. I have a picture on my title slide. And they rarely leave the thick grasses where they live, so otherwise they'd be easily swept up by a large darner dragonfly or maybe a bird. So they stay low and they eat little bugs.
So dragonflies, you know, I'm always locked in thinking, well, it's summertime, maybe occasionally I see one or I'm aware of the fact that I'm seeing one, but apparently there's a lot of them and they're around all the time, and it just may be that my eye isn't tuned properly.
They are around all the time, but unless your head's underwater during, say, October to April, you're not going to see them. So
that explains part of it.
Yeah. So they get through the winter, the fall and winter, either as an egg or as a larva. And some of those larvae can live 5 years, which is pretty impressive for an insect. But come April or May or June, depending on the species, those larvae will crawl out of the water, and they start gulping air, and they split their back open. And out that split in their back crawls a fully formed dragonfly that just needs to kind of stretch itself out and elongate, pump fluid into the veins of its wings, and become an adult dragonfly.
So tonight, for people who come to see the presentation, just give a little thumbnail sketch of what you've put together without giving away too much.
Yeah, of course. Although there's lots of neat little stories to talk about, and I will tonight. So I'll start off just about with dragonfly basics. I'll talk a lot about dragonflies generally, their life history, their behavior, what they eat, their ecology, who eats them, and things like that. And tell nice little stories. And then finish up the second half with how to know the dragonflies of Alaska. So you may not know it, but Bob Armstrong and I published a field guide to the dragonflies of Alaska, all 32 species, and it's a nice little guide, and you can use that to identify them in hand if you can catch them, or maybe through binoculars or a photograph. So I'll just take the audience through the different families that occur here and talk about some of the more interesting dragonflies that we have.
Slides or...
Yep, PowerPoint presentation with lots of photos by our locally famous and stately famous Bob Armstrong, wonderful naturalist and photographer.
So how did you become an expert on dragonflies?
I became an expert on dragonflies of Alaska because nobody else studies them in this state. So if you want to become an expert on something, move to Alaska and start counting or identifying things. So in 1996, I was working down in Ketchikan on Revilla Island. I was talking to my dad on the phone. He's an entomologist, and that's how I got into this little hobby. And he mentioned he was traveling around the Great Lakes collecting dragonflies just to see what types live there. Nobody had ever done that. And I thought, well, I ought to do that in Alaska. So 10 years later, we had published a guide, and we've got a second edition out, and really enjoyed traveling around the state, helping people understand what dragonflies they have in their backyard and different wildlife refuges and stuff.
And do you know that you've identified all the species in Alaska, or is there still some mystery edge out there on this body of research?
If you plotted on a curve number of species discovered in Alaska versus time, it's definitely plateaued. So the last new species that I've found, a new record for Alaska, not a new species to science, was in 2010 in the Canute National Wildlife Refuge.
Where's that?
Yeah, that I'll talk about that tonight.
I'll have to show
nobody
up.
Knows about it. It's millions of acres on the Arctic Circle, and it gets about 11 visitors a year, human visitors, that is.
So you truly have canvassed the entire state.
I have not touched a fraction of the state. I've been to a lot of places, but it's huge. It's huge.
I'll have to rephrase that.
So, yeah.
You've been a lot of places.
Yeah, I'd love to canvass the entire state looking for dragonflies, but haven't covered it all yet.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a great presentation. Patricia, for people who, I forget, do you serve refreshments and things like that?
Yeah. Well, this is free to the public, and we do serve refreshments. And we are working jointly. We have a joint agreement with public library out there, so we don't collect any monies. In the past, we've been places where we could take donations, but this is a no donation thing at all. And they were free before. They're still free. We do refreshments. We're great at making cookies. And we try to have enough time so people can visit and talk too, because this is it's an opportunity for social gathering of people who are interested in critters.
Very good. So we've kind of come to the end of our time. But, John, you told me something that I didn't know when you sat down already, just that it's the state insect. Is that correct?
It is. Apparently in 1995, they decided we needed a state insect in Alaska. So they put it out to the fourth graders around the state, and they had a choice between the mosquito, and there are at least 30 species, so I'm not sure which species, but who cares. And the four-spotted skimmer dragonfly, Libellula quadrimaculata,
wow,
which translates to four-spotted dragonfly.
I'm just betting the majority of the audience is going, really?
Yeah. So by a margin of 2-1, the dragonfly won out, and it now represents Alaska as our state insect. And it's a species that occurs around the world, so it's kind of neat, all over Alaska, too.
Yeah, so just a tidbit, one little fun fact, and I'm sure your presentation this evening is filled with a lot of interesting facts about
dragonflies. Oh, thanks for asking that. So everyone has got to come out to find out why dragonfly larvae employ ballistic defecation. And so I'll,
quote, unquote.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll leave it on ballistic defecation. John Hudson, thank you very much for coming in. Sounds like it's going to be a great presentation this evening. Patricia, always good to see you. Thanks for getting the series going again for residents of Juneau.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jamie.
7-8.
This is Bird Note. Just a couple of dozen miles off the Pacific coast, immense dark birds with long saber-shaped wings glide without effort above the wave tops. These graceful giants are black-footed albatrosses, flying by the thousands near the edge of the continental shelf. Albatrosses arc and coast over the ocean for hours with hardly a flap of their wings. Making the most of wind currents and shifts in air pressure, these wondrous seabirds seem to levitate over the water. black-footed albatross numbers peak off the coast in summer. Many adults return to the Hawaiian Islands during our winter and spring to court and nest on sandy islands. In Hawaiian waters, the black-footed albatross collects squid and masses of flying fish eggs with its long, hook-tipped bill. Adult birds may fly hundreds of miles at sea to provide food for the single Goliath nestling, which looks more than a little like a portly, gray, recumbent version of Big Bird. Writers for BirdNote include Rick Wright, Dennis Paulson, Todd Peterson, and Ellen Blackstone. Our lead writer is Bob Sundstrom, and the producer is John Kessler. I'm Michael Stein.
Sitka Whale Fest is celebrating its 20th anniversary, November 4th through the 6th. Join us for a fun and exciting weekend featuring wildlife cruises, an artisan market, a student art show, and a fun run. At the heart of this festival is a unique science symposium, blending local knowledge and scientific research about our marine environment. Ketchikan-based artist Ray Troll will be our keynote speaker. Visit sitkawhalefest.org for more information and to buy tickets. See you at Whale Fest.
Next topic on a Juno Afternoon is Juno's Air Quality Monitoring Program, which just began October 1st, correct?
Yeah. Correct.
October 1st, and it runs through April 30th. We have Carrie Cummings and Dan Blydorn and Rachel Friedlander, and you, all three of you have longer titles that come after your names, but you're with the Department of Environmental Conservation, CBJ, a couple of people with CBJ. So, but you're all part of an important program here in the capital city, and that's the Air Quality Monitoring Program, which, if I'm correct, is tied to kind of the winter season. So why don't we just start with Rachel?
Yeah, so we are here to share with the community what their local government does to keep the air clean and healthy during the winter season. The Air Quality Monitoring Program is a partnership with the City and Borough of Juneau, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and the NOAA Weather Station on Back Loop Road, and we all work together as a team to keep the air clean. Next to me is Carrie Cummings with DEC, and we work with her most closely when we're trying to look at the data and see, is there an upcoming air inversion? And Dan can define that after Carrie speaks a little bit about what does it mean to collect data and how do we assess air quality in the valley?
Yeah, and actually let me ask about that. Are we, just to get people oriented here, is this program really a valley-based program? And this is about the temperatures get cold and the wood stoves start firing up and then there's the potential of the inversion layer. That's what we're kind of talking about?
Right.
Okay, that's great. All right, good. Just wanted to get that clear.
Well, the DEC monitors in most of Alaska's major cities. We have monitoring stations in Anchorage, the Matsu, Fairbanks, North Pole, and here in Juneau. In Juneau, we're primarily concerned with particulate matter, which is a problem when we get inversions in the wintertime and people are burning their wood stoves. So, Dan, if you want to talk a little bit about inversions.
So really, the problem is mainly occurs when there's an air inversion in the Mendenhall Valley. And that is a situation when, under normal atmospheric conditions, the air gets colder as you rise in elevation. And an air inversion sets up when the air gets warmer as you rise. So the warm air settles above the cold air and acts as a cap. And if this air inversion stays in place for a couple of days, it prevents wood smoke and other particulates from being cleared out naturally. So as they build up, the air becomes unhealthy. And so with the help of the Weather Service and the information provided and data from the DEC, we can look at the situation and assess and see if we need to call an air emergency. So we predict when the levels will be reaching an unhealthy level. And so then we monitor that. And when it seems like the air inversion is beginning to break up or the concentration decreases below the levels that are allowed, then we can cancel that air emergency.
So when there is an air emergency, what's the expectation of residents? What are people supposed to do?
Well, we're actually trying to do a little bit more of a preventative measure this season by sending out direct mailers and having Facebook posts go out about air quality. It's particularly the blue, sunny days where it's really cold and crisp that an air inversion can happen. So if, as a Valley resident, you see that the day is going to look very clear, then you could know or maybe predict that an air inversion is going to happen. And when an actual air inversion is in place, the city will send out a PSA. We have 11 neon yellow signs in the valley that get flipped to let people know when there's a burn ban. And we also have a wood smoke hotline, 586-5333. You can call that and we'll have it pre-recorded to let you know if an air inversion is in effect, so a burn ban is in place, or if it's canceled, in addition to Facebook. Mm-hmm. So we have a variety of measures, but if, as a Valley resident, you want to take a guess at when an air inversion would be in place, look out for those blue, sunny, clear, cold days.
You can also find information on our website, juno.org, under Hot Topics, and we'll have a banner that shows up, so when there is an air emergency in place, it will be a big red banner stating air emergency in effect. And the main thing that residents need to be aware of, when we have an air emergency in effect, there's no burning wood stoves. So you can't use your wood stove in your home during air emergencies.
Mm-hmm. So what do people do? If they're usually relying upon a wood stove, then what's their backup? They have to have a backup, I assume.
Yeah, they have to have a backup. And city code dictates that wood stoves can't be your primary source of heat. So mm-hmm. So generally speaking, most people have electric heat or oil baseboards or something like that that they can supplement their wood stove with.
And if somebody doesn't comply, what happens?
Oh, then the fun begins. No, actually, we work with the Juneau Police Department.
Well, people need to know. Yeah,
exactly. Because there is an enforcement part of this program. And so we contact the Juneau Police Department whenever we have a change in our wood smoke program. So when we call an air emergency, we work with the community service officers. And they do just a fantastic job going out there. And a lot of times they receive or we receive complaints from citizens. And so then the community service officers go out and talk with people about the burn ban and the air emergency program. And they do have the authority to write warnings and give tickets if people continue to burn after burn bans are in effect.
That being said, though, the Valley has been exceptional. I mean, the city has been in compliance with keeping the air clean and healthy. So we are just so grateful for the Valley residents working with the city and the DEC and NOAA to make sure that the air remains clean.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Valley residents.
Yes.
And is that the only part of the Juneau area that has this particular situation? Is the Valley proper?
So the Valley proper has a burn ban. Same with Lemon Creek.
Mm-hmm.
No open burning, I should say. Both Lemon Creek and the Valley have no open burning, and the Valley has a no burn ban policy from October 1st to April 30th.
Anything? So I think for people who've lived here for a long time, they're familiar with this. They know what it is. They understand. So, but newcomers maybe are hearing about it for the first time. But is there anything new and different this year that you want people to be aware of? I think, Rachel, you said you were just trying to be a little more proactive about preventative measures that people might take. Are there other new elements of the public relations campaign this year that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so we'll have a direct mailer going out to all Valley residents. I believe it's going to be either the very end of October or the beginning of November, just going over the basics of what an air inversion is, how the city monitors it, our partnership with the DEC and NOAA, maybe some interesting or engaging pictures, because it's something that we have to do every October 1st to April 30th, but we want to make it engaging, informative, and just let the community know this is what their local government is doing to help clean the air, keep the air clean.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And if there are any questions, I'd encourage people to email us or stop by our office or call our office phone number, which is 586-5252. We're happy to answer any questions or talk about the program and just work with people to make sure they understand what's going on and just help educate people.
Mm-hmm. And Carrie, anything else to add from your perspective here?
Not too much, but if people in the Valley are interested, the DEC has their burnwise.alaska.gov website that has some great information on burning dry wood and general maintenance to help keep the particulates down.
So it sounds like the CBJ website and or the DEC website for people who want to learn more. Anything else you wanted to mention today before we wrap it up?
I wouldn't mind reminding people that the Wood Smoke Hotline number is 586-5333, and that has a recorded message, so you can dial that number. And if there's an air emergency in effect, you'll see that there. There'll be the recording that will tell you.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for running the program, for starters, because obviously having healthy air is important to all of us, so that's important. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much,
Jamie.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank
you. And with just a few minutes left on the Juneau afternoon, it's time for the Zippity Doodah Family Concert. And this is a fundraiser for the Juneau Co-op's preschool. And I just know that there are a lot of kids, a lot of Juneau kids and a lot of Juneau families over many, many years that have participated and made this this fundraising event happen. So, Rhonda, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
Real quickly, tell us about the fundraiser. What's in store?
This is a program designed specifically for little kids. It's only going to go for an hour, so attention spans don't have to be real long. And we are going to be doing it this Saturday, October 8th, at the Northern Light United Church, upstairs from preschool. And we're going to do it not during nap time, not during snack time. It's from 11 to noon. And and we have lined up a couple storytellers. We have Lily Hudson-Hope, who's a current preschool parent who's going to tell a story, and Margie Hamburger, who's a good friend of mine who is an alumni preschool parent. The both of them are going to tell some stories. We have some alumni kids from Juneau Dance Theater who are going to be coming and doing a little ballet for us. And we have another another alumni who just graduated from high school, Keely Ewing, who's going to perform a little musical act with percussion and preschool percussion instruments. And we have a few string players who are alumni who are going to come and play. And then there's a zip band, myself, John Lager, Sophia Butler, Heidi Johnson, Terry Schwartz, and Reed Tibbetts, who are all going to get up there and sing some song, sing along for the kids.
So you have music, you got storytelling,
we have it
basic
all.
Fun
yep.
hour,
yep.
totally calibrated to the age of the kids
yep.
and the families that are there.
Yep, and you come on in, you sit down, you have a good time, and then one of you wrap it up at the end, and there's a bake sale if you want, and it's a suggested donation. So come regardless, it's kind of pay as you will, but there's suggested donation of $5 per adult at the door and $3 per child.
So it's an annual fun event, but
it is
a fundraiser.
You are
hoping to raise a little bit of money, correct?
Yep, okay. We're hopeful.
Very good. So real quickly, the date and time again?
This Saturday, October 8th, 11 to 12 noon at Northern Light.
Well, congratulations. I don't know how many years it is annual, but it's been a
long
time.
Way before I was
so
there.
So congratulations.
Yep.
Rhonda, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jamie.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also